Welcome to the Omfit podcast.
Welcome to you all, wherever you are around the world. Welcome to you, Phil Gerson, Deputy Director of the IMF's European Department in Washington. Phil, this talk is about the report that you brought out around about 6 weeks ago, just before Christmas, the IMF's report on the euro area, which is part of the regular consultative mechanisms. You make a number of recommendations and points about the pandemic. As always, the IMF wants a bit more expansion, monetary and fiscal in variety. Could you talk us through the main points of your report, please? So over to you, Phil.
Sure. Thank you very much, David, and thank you to OMFIF for the opportunity to be here today. The report itself is available on the IMF website. So rather than go through a comprehensive review of what's in the document, I'll just highlight some things. And I want to start with a statement that I think is obvious, but that bears emphasis because it's going to color everything that I have to say today. We're operating under extraordinary uncertainty, and I think that's something that needs to be kept firmly in mind when you evaluate anything that I say. I think really anything that anyone has to say about short and medium. The primary source of that uncertainty is the virus. As in much of the world, the euro area has been hit extremely hard by the pandemic with devastating human and economic costs. The development of the vaccine obviously gives suggestion that there may finally be light at the end of the tunnel, but the rollout of the vaccine has proven more difficult than many people may have expected, even in advanced economies. It would be usually ironic and a tragedy if this great intellectual event, the development of not just one, but multiple effective vaccines, were stymied by something as prosaic as issues related to the production, distribution, and distribution of the vaccine. But for as long as the virus continues to spread and to mutate, discussions about the future are going to be subject to a huge amount of uncertainty. So with that as background, with that obvious statement as background, let me make a second obvious statement that unprecedented policy responses at the EU level, at the euro area level, and at the national level have been crucial in helping to cushion the impact on Europe of the pandemic. In particular, lifelines to households and firms have helped protect jobs and livelihoods, supported by both central fiscal funds and monetary policy actions, and helped stabilize employment despite the steep drop in output. Let me cover a little bit of the background of what's happened since the report came out as well. After a very sharp decline in output in the second quarter that reflects the impact of the shutdowns in response to the pandemic, output in the euro area bounced back very strongly in the third quarter, much more strongly, in fact, than we had expected. But new lockdowns late in 2020 in response to further waves of the pandemic have led to weaker economic activity in the fourth quarter and therefore weaker growth momentum going into the new year. While the flash estimates for euro area quarter four GDP were better than many people had feared they might be, it's nonetheless the case that the euro area entered 2021 in a difficult position. And the more difficult start to the year is reflected, for example, in weaker PMIs, especially in services, and in reduced retail mobility in January. The expectation that renewed lockdowns would depress output in the fourth quarter and would carry over into early this year is reflected in the January update to the IMF's World Economic Outlook, which came out, as the name suggests, came out last month. And I should note that came out before the quarter four flash data were available. We expect real GDP to grow by about 4.25% in the euro area this year. But that January forecast is a full percentage point lower than what we had expected in October when the previous WEO was published, which reflects the impact of these renewed lockdowns. It's also a full percentage point lower, this 4.25% is a full percentage point lower than the growth forecast for the U.S. in 2021, despite the fact that the decline in U.S. output last year was much smaller than that of the euro area. Moreover, while the U.S. and Japan are expected to regain their 2019 output levels later this year, that is to say, at some point this year, they'll be back to where they were prior to the start of the crisis. For the euro area, output is expected to remain below its 2019 level into next year. So going forward, the euro area authorities face, I think, three key challenges. One is to sustain supportive policies for longer than initially anticipated, given the arrival of these multiple waves of the virus. Secondly, fostering the post-pandemic transition to reflect a changing economic landscape. And third, to address crisis legacies, including especially, I think, the impact on inequality, both within the region, both within individual regions in the euro area and across the euro area overall. Our staff report makes several recommendations in this area. Again, I won't go through them all, but I'll just do some of the highlights. First, on fiscal policy, policy will need to remain supportive longer than expected because of these multiple waves, despite higher debt levels, and countries should avoid tightening until the recovery is fully underway. But over time, the mix of policies is going to need to evolve from providing generalized support to more targeted interventions that will encourage the movement of workers and capital towards firms and industries that are more likely to be viable in the post-pandemic world. And eventually, but inevitably, high debt countries will need to begin a gradual process of consolidation to restore the fiscal buffers that have been eroded during the crisis. Second, the Next Generation EU package is not only an important demonstration of European solidarity, but it could also have significant macroeconomic effects. Maximizing the impact of the Recovery and Resilience Fund will depend on the quality of the investment and finances, the degree to which those investments are additional rather than simply replace what was already planned, and third, the extent to which they catalyze rather than substitute for necessary structural reforms. I want to talk about also briefly about what the RRF is not, what the Recovery and Resilience Fund is not. The RRF is not the centralized countercyclical fiscal capacity that the fund has advocated for a long time. But successful experience with the RRF could help lay the groundwork for the eventual introduction of such a capacity. Third, monetary policy should remain accommodative for as long as necessary to achieve the ECB's medium-term inflation aim. The recalibration of monetary policy instruments at the ECB Governing Council's December meeting was welcome, but further accommodation could prove necessary depending on inflation developments, especially in a downside scenario. While we don't discount the concerns about an extended period of monetary accommodation and the risks that it might imply, we believe the benefits of monetary policy accommodation continue to outweigh those risks. Fourth, the authorities will face a delicate balancing act to ensure that going forward, banks continue to be part of the solution and do not become part of the problem. The European financial system entered this crisis in a stronger position than it did the last one, and accommodative financial policies have supported lending. Nonetheless, medium-term strategies to reduce non-performing loans and to strengthen insolvency strategies to reduce NPLs and strengthen insolvency regimes will help accelerate balance sheet repair. Closing gaps in the EU's crisis management framework, including through the recent progress on ESM treaty reform, will help complete the banking union. Advancing other financial sector architecture reforms would also be welcome. Last but certainly not least, structural policies will have to play a key role in facilitating resource reallocation, limiting scarring, and protecting the vulnerable. A combination of several policies, including adjusting job retention schemes, promoting job search, and providing carefully targeted hiring subsidies supported by product market reforms, will likely be necessary to achieve these multiple objectives. More broadly, to make sure that people are not left behind, a more fundamental rethink of how to adapt labor market policies to respond to accelerating automation and to facilitate green and digital transformations may be needed. So that's a summary of the main conclusions of the report. Again, the report itself is available on the IMF website. And with that summary, I'd welcome any questions that you might have.
Yeah, thanks very much, Phil. Well, I would certainly recommend people do go to the website and read it. It's 77 pages. So brainy people like you can get through that in about 20 minutes. And it's very well laid out and extremely well argued. If I could just go into one or two of these points, it's a very meaty subject here, Phil. You make the point about inequality, and you make that on several different occasions. What do you think about the differences in amongst the individual countries in the European Monetary Union regarding the pace of recovery? Because it's very noticeable, isn't it, that some countries have had a better crisis than others. They've all had a pretty torrid time, but the gap in the growth contraction is quite large. Germany has got the same debt to GDP as it did in 2011, whereas the Italian debt to GDP, public sector debt, has gone up by about 50%. Are you worried about the pace of recovery in individual countries will be quite non-standard? Is that an area of concern for you?
It is. I think, you know, you're certainly correct that the crisis hit different countries to a different extent. And I think there are a number of, that reflects probably a number of factors. One is that the crisis itself physically arrived in some economies more rapidly than it did others. The structure of the euro area economies differs across countries. There are some countries where tourism is a much more prominent element of the economy than others. And tourism and hospitality in general is one sector that was especially hard hit by the crisis. So I think some of the different experience reflects that. Some of it may reflect differences in their healthcare systems. I think all the countries in Europe have, or in the euro area, I should say, have aspects in common with their healthcare systems, but still there are different capacities of healthcare systems. And that may also have affected the extent to which the crisis struck different countries. In addition, it's important to note that countries had different amounts of fiscal space coming into the crisis, and that may also have affected their ability to respond to the crisis. But I think coming out of the crisis, we do have those concerns about the ability of countries to respond. And some of that does reflect these differences in fiscal space, the fact that there are some countries that would seem to have much more space to respond with fiscal policy to the crisis and to address some of these priorities that I laid out in discussing the recommendations of the report. There are a couple of things to be done about that. One is, as I mentioned, there's been a huge response at the central area, at the central fiscal area to the crisis. Next Generation EU is one example. The pandemic support facility that the ESM has come out with is another. There's SURE, the European Commission's response to help support unemployment insurance for affected individuals. So there are a lot of resources at the central area, and it will be important for countries whose fiscal space is more limited to make full use of those. The other point that I would make is that it's important that countries not tighten policy too quickly. There will be, I think, huge pressure, particularly on highly indebted countries, to respond to the crisis by tightening fiscal policy. We've seen a huge increase in debt levels everywhere, and there's obviously going to be pressure associated with that to bring debt levels down. But I think it's key that countries not react too early to that. They wait until there's clear evidence that the recovery is firmly on the economy is firmly on a path to recovery before they begin to tighten.
Are you calling here for, if you like, a convoy approach, that those with the fiscal space, goes back to very much traditional arguments from the IMF in past years, those like Germany and the Netherlands and the Austrians and so on, they use their fiscal space and they go into the front line, if you like, and let those with greater indebtedness carry out some modest consolidation with the those less indebted countries perhaps taking up the strain?
Well, I think clearly it would be helpful for economies with less fiscal space if those with more fiscal space took on additional investment. But I think there's a strong case in those countries with more fiscal space to do it for their own benefit. I think the EU has set out important goals in terms of addressing the impact of climate change, and there's a key case for investment in that area to facilitate the response to climate change. There's a case for improving digitalization, and there's a key case for investment there as well. So obviously there would be important spillovers if countries with more fiscal space used that. But I think there's an argument in their own right. It doesn't necessarily need to be purely a case of lack of self-interest that would motivate these countries. It's not just beneficence towards their fellow euro area members. I think there's a strong internal case for increasing investment in these countries as well.
What about the side effects of over-accommodation? You carefully mentioned that there are these side effects. You take those into account. You say, nonetheless, the risks of too much accommodation are actually relatively low compared with the risks of not enough accommodation in the monetary sphere. Nonetheless, are you worried that there might be some element of pro-cyclicality creeping in to the euro area, maybe towards the end of this year? If you have the fiscal approach, which is going to be on expansion, you have the Next Generation Fund, which, if spent wisely and well, will deliver a big stimulus, and you have a lot of monetary easing, could that not lead to a greater degree of inflation than the ECB would like?
We are certainly, as you note, aware of the risks that come, particularly on the monetary policy side, from an extensive and extended period of monetary accommodation. At the same time, we do think, as you pointed out, that the risks associated with tightening monetary policy too soon would be greater than the risks of continuing with monetary policy accommodation. We've seen some pickup in inflation if you look at the January data, but inflation remains well below the ECB's medium-term aim. And we expect coming out of the crisis, that even as the economy gets back on its, even as the recovery continues and the economies get back on the path to recovery, we expect there to be a considerable output gap for some time. And so for those reasons, we think there's a strong case for continued monetary policy accommodation. Like the ECB is an inflation targeter. Inflation is likely to remain below its medium-term aim for some time. And so there's a clear case for accommodation. There are risks that come from excessive financial accommodation. We don't see those risks as, and in fact, there were some imbalances arising even before the crisis, but we don't see those risks rising dramatically. And if they do, there are macro financial measures that can be taken and prudential measures that can be taken to try to contain those. But for the time being, we definitely see the risks of tightening monetary policy too soon, derailing the recovery, and frankly, dealing with the financial stability impacts of a derailed recovery. We see the risks of, for those reasons, we see the risks of monetary tightening exceeding the risks that would be associated with continued accommodation right now.
Do you think the spirit of 2008 and 2011, when the ECB definitely did tighten money at the wrong time, that was under a different regime, of course, when Jürgen Stark was playing a big role on the council. Do you think that spirit still somehow haunts the ECB? One remembers when Mario Draghi got in November 2011, the first thing he did was to totally reverse those interest rate increases. And of course, since then, the ECB has eased ever since.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say that it haunts, but certainly, you know, all institutions try to learn from previous crises. At the fund, we think we've learned from previous crises and tried to apply those lessons. And again, you know, the ECB is an inflation targeter. Inflation is below the aim and is expected to continue to be below its aim. And that calls for continued accommodation.
I wanted to bring in Mario Draghi. I know you don't want to talk too much about individual countries and personalities, but nonetheless, there is now a potentially quite a wonderful balance now coming our way. You've got Mario Draghi, age 73, same age as Adenauer was when he took over as German Chancellor in 1949, potentially helping the Italians to spend the recovery fund money much more wisely and much more well with great degree of efficiency. Could that somehow, if everything goes well, lead to a greater and a better balance between monetary and fiscal policy in the euro area? Because the ECB, by common consent, has been doing a great deal, maybe too much of the heavy lifting over the last 2 or 3 years. Could a greater degree of efficiency in using public money, particularly in Italy, pave the way for the ECB to scale back some of its purchases? Everybody would be very happy, I think, if the ECB were to have to do less and the governments were to do more.
I think clearly there's a role for fiscal policy to contribute to promoting growth, both growth of current output and potential growth. The Next Generation EU, as I mentioned, is one avenue for that. The impact of the Next Generation EU will be maximized if the money is spent wisely on investments with high multipliers. There's a role for investment in individual countries in the euro area as well. So I think there's lots of room for fiscal policy to support a recovery. And to the extent that the recovery begins more quickly, output gaps close and we begin to see inflation pick up, that would create scope for the ECB to begin, adjusting some of the extraordinary accommodation that they've provided so far.
You mentioned the recovery fund, the Next Generation Fund, and in your report, you give a lot of, absolutely justified glowing praise to this because it was quite a breakthrough. In July last year, we remember that four-day summit or four-night summit in Brussels. Are you happy with the progress on this so far? It seems to be taking a bit of time for this thing to be getting off the ground.
Well, first of all, we certainly underscore the really path-breaking nature of the Next Generation EU funds. You know, as long as countries continue to be able to borrow at very low interest rates, The rollout of the next generation EU funds, whether it comes a few months earlier or a few months later, is not as critical as making sure that it's done correctly. And so we look forward to the implementation of next generation EU. We look forward to looking at the individual country plans, and seeing what policies they and what investments they can plan to finance. As I mentioned, it's critical that this not be seen as a substitute for structural reform, that this needs to be a complement for structural reform as well. And so we look forward to seeing how country structural reform plans are woven into their next generation EU plans. But overall, we don't see the delays so far as being anything that would critically impair the ability of the next generation EU to program to contribute significantly to output growth.
Will the IMF in some way be helping individual countries and the European Commission to monitor the way that the next generation fund is spent, both in loans and grants? Because you do have quite a lot of technical expertise and quite a lot of experience. Have they asked you for your advice on this?
I'm not aware that they've asked specifically. We do a lot of technical assistance and capacity development. That tends to occur primarily in lower income countries. But nonetheless, we do things like public investment management analysis and public expenditure reviews, including in advanced economies. So that's one avenue that that this could follow. Of course, as part of the Article 4 process in general, for every IMF member country, we do a deep dive on fiscal policy and on expenditure, and it could arise from that as well. You pointed out that the Euro area report is 70-something pages. That's not by IMF standards a particularly long staff report. So you can tell just from the page count that we go into a great deal of detail in analyzing countries' plans. And so it would be natural that this is something that the fund would be looking at very closely as well.
Yes, well, that's probably a good sign that it's not gone to more than 100. Then that means they're in a bit of a mess, probably. And no, so I take your point on that. One of the aspects of the Next Generation Fund, which a lot of people, I'm sure, also on the call are interested in, is the role of the euro. There will be this borrowing by the European Union, large-scale borrowing, and it will be backed up. The repayment will be backed by own resources. Some people have called this a Hamiltonian moment. We all know Hamiltonian moment was slightly different. I don't know whether you want to go into the question whether you think this is now a permanent facility that will give the European Union, therefore, permanent own resources and would, therefore, bring it closer to the long sought after fiscal union. Would you like to take a stab on that one, Phil?
Sure. You know, a lot depends on what happens with the next generation EU, on how successful it's seen as being, on whether or not the investments that it finances are seen as being productive, on whether or not it does help promote structural reform as well. This is not, as I mentioned, and as you mentioned as well, the countercyclical fiscal instrument that we have long advocated for the euro area. We think some sort of centralized fiscal capacity would be extremely useful as a stabilization tool, and this is not that. But this does the next generation EU, if it's implemented successfully, if it's seen as helping contribute in a meaningful way, could lay the groundwork for the eventual adoption of that countercyclical fiscal instrument. So we're not there yet by any means, but we can certainly see how a successful rollout of the next generation EU would be a step on that path, and conversely, how a failure to capitalize on the next generation EU could set back the hoped for progress in centralized fiscal capacity. So it will be important that this be done carefully.
Good. So it could be very much a step in the right direction, but we're not there straight away. I'm going to open up the questioning to the audience in just 1 minute or so, starting off with Danai Kirikopoulou and Katharina Nice. So please get ready to ask your questions, the two of you. But just before we get on to that, another feature of the Next Generation Fund is that this could possibly be giving a bit more of a stimulus to the euro as a proper international reserve currency, because it's number two to the dollar, but quite a long way behind. Some people think that the very fact that the EU will be borrowing big time in euro, this could enter into a lot of sovereign reserve holdings. What do you think about that? Is this at all important, whether the euro becomes something more of a rival to the dollar as the international currency par excellence?
you know, the euro has very, very slowly increased its role as a reserve currency. When the euro was first officially issued in 1999, something like 3/4 of global reserves were held in dollars, and I think 18% was the number for the euro. As of the 3rd quarter of last year, it was 60% dollars and about 20% in the euro. So there's been a very small increase in the role of the euro as a reserve currency. I think this reflects a number of factors. One, as you mentioned, is the lack of a safe asset, a euro-denominated safe asset. And with the creation of the Next Generation EU and the Recovery and Resilience Fund, the ability of the Commission to borrow in its own name, this will help address some of that. In fact, there'll be, I think, a significant increase in the stock of euro-denominated assets just because of that, particularly when you keep in mind that a lot of the debt that's been issued by AAA-rated sovereigns has been bought by the ECB. So the Next Generation EU could actually lead to a significant increase in what's available to borrow. And if you look at the financing of European supranationals like the European Investment Bank and the ESM, probably about half of the demand for these new Next Generation EU assets will come from outside Europe. So that'll be a step in the right direction. In addition, the traditional channel of reserve accumulation through trade, with the EU's continued commitment to strong multilateral engagements, should help as well. If the Next Generation EU leads to greater competitiveness of European firms, that should help as well. So I think there are a combination of reasons to think that the reserve role of the euro will continue to rise over time. But I think we also need to recognize that the dollar is going to maintain its dominant role for some time, that the euro's role as a reserve currency can continue to rise, but it's a long way behind the dollar and will probably be so for some time.
Apt way of ending it. And I think it's important also that these reforms are now being ordained by the European Union themselves and not brought in by the International Monetary Fund, which wasn't really the finest hour of the IMF, I think, 10 years ago. And this needs to be done on a homegrown basis, I think. Therefore, one could easily say the European Union has somehow grown up over the last 10 years and is now taking on the strain itself. Thank you so much, Phil Gerson, for taking us through this quite complex subject matter, a mixture of monetary and fiscal and politics. It's been very kind of you, and we look forward to engaging with you more in the future and also to looking at your recommendations, particularly on the fiscal side. It's mostly fiscal and so on, all the old cliches. Therefore, having a session between you and your colleagues in the fiscal department and Niels Tuggesen at the European Fiscal Board and your joint views on the review of the fiscal rules, I think something in the next few months could be very useful indeed. Phil, many thanks indeed, and over to you, and enjoy the rest of the day in Washington.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.